The time is 1992, where we have Nick Holloway, played by Chevy Chase, a strong analyst who becomes invisible after a mysterious laboratory accident at a high-tech research facility. As Nick struggles to adapt to his new condition, he finds himself pursued by a ruthless CIA operative, David Jenkins, played by Sam Neill, who wants to exploit Nick's invisibility for covert espionage. On the run and desperate for his life back, Nick seeks help from his love interest, Alice Monroe, played by Daryl Hannah. Nick not only has to juggle invisibility and romance, but also attempt to outwit the government and reclaim his life. This week on Back to the Balcony, we cover the 1992 John Carpenter film, Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony.
Okay, so this one I know I've had on the back burner. I have been wanting to talk about this movie, but right time, right place. This was a childhood favorite. Watching up and growing up, watching the original 1933 Invisible Man with Claude Rains, this is what struck me as a kind of an amateur into film as a kid. Chevy Chase's performance made me think before mass reboots and remakes, that this was almost a direct sequel, just with added stakes, special effects, and a lot of the moments in the film that takes this movie a couple octaves up when it comes to the adventure. But Chevy Chase's performance is what sells me on this, because it reminds me of Rains' performance to a T. Add that with the noir style, the different kind of take on it. It almost is a detective story along with a monster movie, along with an espionage story. This has all the elements that it tries to juggle. And I'll get into some of the flaws of juggling all these elements later. I'm sure we're going to discuss it. But this, after a rewatch, is still a fun flick.
Yeah, no, I agree. This is definitely in my wheelhouse, because it is known to be the infamous misfire of John Carpenter's career. After having so many prolific movies throughout the 80s, he starts the 90s with this, you know. And I'm not going to say that he's sold out to Hollywood to do a big budget special effects movie. Doing it in like the Hollywood fashion, not doing his own score, not necessarily taking over the story. He essentially picked this up from previous attempts to make this version. This was actually a Chevy Chase kind of fan flick. He discovered the novel before it was published. He was very involved with the development into a movie as it slipped through the hands of different directors and eventually fell into John Carpenter's hand. I feel like John Carpenter was definitely the right guy to do this. However, you can tell that the movie screams of behind-the-scenes turmoil, creative differences. It's got infamous history for that, too. But even with all of that, you cannot take away the passion that Chevy Chase has for this role and the passion that John Carpenter has for making the film his way. Even with all of the fights he probably had with the cast and the producers, you can still say and see that this is a John Carpenter film. So I think that's where it really works for me, is that if you look at all the critics' reviews of its time, it's like 28% favorable. Everybody hated it. It was a bomb. Lots of people don't like this movie because it doesn't feel like a Chevy Chase movie, 100%, and it doesn't feel like a John Carpenter movie to people who are used to movies like The Thing and They Live, right? It has John Carpenter tropes, but not necessarily a John Carpenter feeling, and that's why I like it. It's a little bit out of the box. So when you brought this to the table, I was really, really excited, and you hit the nail right on the head, and I'm going to hit it even further. This isn't a horror movie. This isn't a monster movie. This is a noir film. I'd say the closest comparison is probably the classic film DOA, which they eventually remade with Dennis Quaid, where the guy is poisoned and he has like day to figure out who poisoned him before it finally kills him. This has a very similar trope. It has a very similar narration and dialogue. While there isn't necessarily a time frame or a time limit like in DOA, there are those stakes of, like, this guy is losing physical control of his body. He's kind of wasting away being invisible while he's on the run. And you have not necessarily a femme fatale, because DOA doesn't really have a femme fatale. It has a femme character. Daryl Hannah brings that to it. So if you look at the film from that aspect, where this does have that kind of gumshoe noir feel to it, but also bringing that universal monster kind of special effects laden flair to it, yeah, it really is special. And Chevy Chase not being hammy and slapsticky, I wish we would have had more performances like this in his career, 100%.
Well, it's like we take Rain's 1933 character, place him in a conspiracy movie with romance, a noir detective story. It all that concept and uniqueness works. But I have to say, where we recognize the flaws of this, and watching this movie year over year, I never pinpointed it because I didn't want to, because I loved it so much, because it's just a fun movie. But during my first rewatch, I've watched it twice this week, I fell asleep within the first 15 minutes, not because of the movie, because I was exhausted. I woke up within the last, 10, 15 minutes. I'm like, I'm going to try it again. I hit rewind, and it amazed me, going back to the 10, 15 minutes, of how much stuff happens within the 10, 15 minutes. We have the introduction to the persona of Chase's character. We have the romance introduction. We have the invisible mishap at the tech company. All this happens within the first 15, 20 minutes. And that kind of tells a story of why I think critics hated this movie, is because it jam-packs a lot of this stuff in the short runtime, where we needed to spread this movie out a little bit. And I never realized how jam-packed this movie was in trying to cover multiple different themes and topics. And at the same time, this is almost the summer movie of jam-packing all these topics into it and just banking on entertainment value. And that's what it does successfully, is it is entertainment. But that is solely driven by the special effects. Not just special effects, but special effects that drive curiosity, not the wow. Show me what, it doesn't go after the look what I can do, but let me show you the curiosity of what these special effects will create this character. So to me, I think this is an octave up from a summer blockbuster movie of what we'd get with jam-packed of special effects and just famous faces on screen. This one actually does something with it that actually does challenge the mind, knowing that this is going to be a shorter runtime with a lot of topics. So how do we test the viewers? How do we wow them with curiosity and imagination? That's what Carpenter really utilizes and leans into the special effects to really do. And you have the attraction to these characters, these stakes that you want to follow, and you are curious on what's going to happen next with these characters.
You know, I think, too, the fact that, I don't know, maybe a lot of people don't realize that when you think about superhero origin stories, they are very symmetrical with horror film origin stories, right? You know, how the Hulk becomes the Hulk is essentially a horror story. It's almost like a Jekyll and Hyde kind of thing. There is so much allusion to modern day superhero origin stories from these classic Universal films, and this really does it. I mean, if you think about it, it's essentially Ant-Man, like the beginning of Ant-Man. Like, okay, he is this stockbroker who is investing in this company, and he goes and relaxes in this building where there is this mishap with the technology that turns him and the building invisible. And now he has to deal with that. The villain of this movie, too. I mean, Sam Neill, this is, and we've talked about Sam Neill already before on the show, this is a year before Jurassic Park, so his hero time has not happened yet. And then his artsy films of the 80s and early 90s, I'd say maybe up to this point, his most prolific was probably Damien or A Cry in the Dark. I'm not sure, but he shows like that hint of villainy that we are going to see from him later on, but also that charm, that smoothness, where he is very dangerous in what his intent is, but at the same time, you don't feel physically threatened by him because he is so charming. It's a great villain role because also it's not hammy. He's not overly doing it. You let Chevy Chase be the ham. And so there are moments in this movie where he does kind of channel his inner Fletch. And I think that's to be expected. You know, the dinner scene or the scene when he's in the bedroom invisible and she's getting changed and that dude comes in. Like, he does have those moments to play Chevy Chase. But I think there is a level of restraint for him. That is, I think, the coolest part about this movie is there's levels of restraint from all characters involved. And I think that's what some audiences and critics were maybe held up against, is they thought they were going to get a Universal monster movie remake with a lot of action, with a lot of special effects. And the special effects, while super impressive, are a mix of practical and CGI. What's brilliant about Carpenter is it's a lot of what you don't see that makes it so cool. The same way he does The Thing, the same way that he does with They Live, where it's more of the presence and the vibe of the movie that is more memorable than the actual on-screen effects or scares. And the fact that we do get this blend of, we get to see Chevy Chase as an audience that he's there, but in the film, he's actually not. Also, Chevy Chase wants to be seen. There's no way he's going to be in an Invisible Man movie where you never see him. So I think, again, that just went over audiences and critics' heads of the day.
Well, even more so, I think it would piss people off if you go to a Chevy Chase movie and you don't see Chevy Chase. So I think that would have been a bigger disappointment to critics, where they don't even know what they want. So even complaining about that, I'm sure we'll get into with our critics' reviews. But even when it comes to Sam Neill, now Sam Neill, this is a Sam Neill performance. We see sparks of villainous that we kind of wish we almost saw in Event Horizon to an extent without special effects. We have the charm where he doesn't have to be this corrupt, evil guy, overly done. He has that slyness, that, like you said, the charm to have people follow him, to kind of see a threat to him. We get a moment where he does come out of his shell and show a little bit of rage in a scene, and that is as much Sam Neill as you're going to get. I love the fact that Sam Neill attacks every role with a calmness and unpredictable sense of, you don't know how he's going to tackle this role, but it's the same way he tackles every other role. It's calm, it's sly, and it's sleek. And that's what I think is really appealing. And I'm a big fan of Sam Neill because his on-screen presence is always there. He almost goes into a role with no idea of what he's going to do, but he just does Sam Neill. And that's what makes him so special, is you can just sit there and watch him as he almost improvises a role to an extent. But I think this is one, when you talk about the practical effects even, this is one where I think, when I said earlier, it attacks the imagination, where some of the best scenes of this isn't where he's running down the street or getting in a cab. It's the things we've always wondered. How do you eat? What's that like if you actually eat something? Do you see the digestion? I think it does a great job on kind of amplifying how he's going to go on the run by hiding not just where he is, but how he eats, where he sleeps. It covers all of that, which I think is what's so special and unique about this movie. If it was any other movie in current times, it would have gone all in on the special effects to see, look what I can do, versus leaving something to the imagination or giving us something that we've always wondered about that we haven't seen before. And even today, we haven't seen anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, except for the Hollow Man and maybe the Invisible Man with Elizabeth Moss, which is, takes a different approach to the whole story whatsoever. But this one, you know, the Invisible Man is not a villain. He is the hero. And it's not like he's an anti-hero that turns into a villain like the original. We're with this guy the whole way. He is a noir character, maybe without the tragic ending, throughout the whole movie. So we are attached to him. He's not going to have a villainous turn. And I think that is what the main difference is between many other versions of this story. Now, this is the thing that I really caught on this particular viewing, is how much Hitchcock this film channels as well. Half the movie is essentially North by Northwest, and I always forget about that, meaning that Sam Neill's character is very adjacent to the James Mason role in North by Northwest, a very smooth, charming, let's say non-threatening in appearance villain. he really plays it very similar. And the connection between Nick and Daryl Hannah, yeah, it does seem a little bit cliche for the movies, like they fall in love rather quickly, but I think they try to fix that in the dialogue with what her character is. You know, she is a documentary filmmaker. She's a very curious person. So by setting that characteristic up for her, it gives her an opportunity to be more open-minded to this weird relationship she finds herself in with this guy. I think they really tried to fix it in the writing, and maybe in execution and editing, it doesn't come off 100%, but I can at least see what they were trying to do to get there, and I bought it. I think that's fine, but you will get a lot of complaints from critics and other audience members about how that feels so undeserved that she can have this fall in love with relationship with him. I mean, but also, it's a movie about an invisible man. Let it go.
Well, it's a fantasy. It's a fantasy.
Right.
I didn't have a problem with the romance, because if you go into it, going into a movie about invisible man, of course, it's going to be a fantasy. It's going to be a fantasy romance. They want to have an outcome and a happy ending. That's what the intent of this movie is. But this is why I think this holds up even more today than it did then. Maybe the standards were a little bit different back then. Yeah, you go out with a girl, you wine and dine, you have a relationship, and then you build upon that. And that's what movies have trained us to do, is to build the romance and build the relationship. But here, it's not too outlandish in current times. You go, you have a couple of drinks, and you end up in a closet somewhere. But I think where the big question mark is, I think what happens after. So you have Daryl Hannah's character wondering, was she ghosted? Was she just done after one date? Was it a one-time thing? So the curiosity of abandonment is present. And Nick, at the same time, is also feeling abandonment because he doesn't know how to reach and communicate with Daryl Hannah without giving himself up. So we have two real conflicts here that the movie doesn't really focus on, per se, but we can feel it as the story plays out, and we can see it gradually draw these two together. So I didn't have a problem with the relationship. I can kind of fill in the blanks, and that's okay. But I think what was missing is just recognizing and identifying it doesn't have to make sense, because this is a movie about an invisible man that's trying to find his life, wants to get his life back. And if he can have the slightest communication of what that moment prior to his incident happened of happiness, he would be happy with that. And I think the movie does that well, but at the same time, I can see where critics went to it, where, like I said earlier, there is a lot that happens within the first 10, 15 minutes to even the 30 minutes to make it feel rushed for that time. Now, not so much.
So, I mean, in hindsight, we're going to hear what our critics have to say about this movie, but what do you think is the main reason why audiences turned on this film? I have a few theories. I mean, for one, Chevy Chase at this point in his career was kind of just an afterthought, right? The 80s were very kind to him, the 90s not so much. He essentially had this and Nothing But Trouble, his failed talk show. It just wasn't a really good time for Chevy Chase. His ego outweighed his success by the time the 90s came, and people put their energy into other actors that he thought of as, let's say, replacements for him in the zeitgeist. You know, this was definitely the decade for Bill Murray. We talked about that in our Bill Murray episode and in the Scrooged episode. So I think that, A, people were just kind of done with Chevy Chase at the time when this came out. I'm going to say that Daryl Hannah, too, doesn't help. You know, she had high spirits before this. Yeah, she had Steel Magnolias, but that was a super bit part. I think people were kind of over Daryl Hannah as well. And as for Carpenter, he has some cult favorites come out in the late 80s, but essentially this was made between Prince of Darkness and In the Mouth of Madness. So this film was such a draining task for him, and the response from critics and from the studios about how this film was just so terrible, it almost drove him away from filmmaking. And he actually made In the Mouth of Madness, which I think was one of his best movies, which really portrays the madness. It's a metaphor, I'm sure, for like the creative process, in his case, filmmaking, in the story's case, horror novel writing, but I think that there was just a lot of bad timing with this movie. The leads were on their way out of the zeitgeist. Him as a filmmaker was struggling to find his creative footing again, almost leaving the industry. And a year away from Jurassic Park, this film does feel kind of antiquated, knowing that that was on the horizon. So I think it was just an unhappy accident of all these different things happening at the same time that kind of made people lose interest in what this film actually was.
It is 100% wrong time, because going into 92 all the way to 93, this is where we've had this conversation before, where it's leading in and crescendoing into the summer blockbuster action movies, horror movies. This is a bad time for a movie that people don't know what it's supposed to be. And we take the cast, and I want to be clear, this isn't my opinion, this is my thought, is this at the time, I think, was the wrong cast, because you touched on it a little bit, but we take Sam Elliott, where we can picture more of a villainous, outlandish role. We can picture somebody else that is more cartoonish in this role. Chevy Chase does a fantastic job, but who could have done it better? Who could have made this more a comedic role, or more of a fantasy, if you will, or a more believable, good-looking icon to be the Invisible Man? So this could have easily turned into a blockbuster. They could have easily taken this concept and made it something totally, completely opposite of what the ending result was. And for 92, this one, I think audiences weren't ready for. If you would have taken this movie with this cast and maybe pushed it to Event Horizon time, maybe it would have done a little bit better. But we also had that argument that Event Horizon didn't do that well with Sam Neill. But in between those Event Horizon and 93's Jurassic Park, I think would have been a driver for this, because I think this would have gotten past the summer blockbuster 93 era and really got given audiences something unique.
And marketing. I mean, the trailer for this and the marketing made it seem like it was a comedy, like it was a laugh out loud sci-fi comedy, and it's most definitely not that. You know, and it's interesting to hear our critics talk about this, because it is very... It's interesting to hear our critics talk about this film, because you can tell that I think they were excited about the concept, but not the execution. Very similar to when they discussed The Bride. They were excited for the prospect of having a modern retelling of The Bride of Frankenstein and were totally disappointed by the execution. Yeah, we had some conflicts with that movie for sure. You and I did when we were reviewing it. But at the same time, I think that their perception of what the movie was and what it could be is what pushed them into such a negative review of that film, because they weren't ready to accept it. They wanted that old Universal monster feeling, and I have a feeling they kind of wanted the same thing of this movie too. So this was Rogers to bring to the show.
Our first movie tells the story of a man who tries to conduct a love affair under the slight handicap that he is completely invisible. The movie is named Memoirs of an Invisible Man, and it stars Chevy Chase in the title role as a victim of an industrial accident. Shortly before he becomes invisible, Chase falls head over heels in love with a bright young filmmaker played by Daryl Hannah. Anyone who has ever seen the original 1933 Claude Rains classic, The Invisible Man, has probably asked certain basic biological questions, such as, even if the guy is invisible, why can't we see the food in his stomach? Well, Memoirs of an Invisible Man does deal with such issues, but somehow it doesn't have enough fun with him. This is another case of a movie getting bogged down in a silly plot about spies and chase scenes and not having the curiosity to really follow the gimmick of invisibility all the way through to see where it might lead. Chevy Chase and Daryl Hannah do the best they can, and they do have some funny moments, but the screenplay has a lot of room for imagination.
Oh, absolutely.
That isn't.
So that is a huge issue of mine with his take on this movie, is that I don't think it's supposed to be fun. Like, they're not going for fun in this movie. They are going for almost like the agony and stress of being invisible and what it does to the human psyche and physicality. There's a scene where he breaks down, where he's talking to Sam Neill about he can't even see his hands when he reaches for a drink. Like, there's lots of dialogue in there, and I'm sure it's mostly from the novel, about how tormenting being invisible is. It is not fun. When Daryl Hannah's telling him all the things he could do about, you could be a bank robber, you could be the best spy, you could go hang out in ladies' locker rooms. Like, those are the things that most of us think about what we would do if we were invisible. And for him, he's like, yeah, but like, I can't eat or wear clothes or even see my own hand or look at myself in the mirror. And that is emotionally taxing. This isn't a fun movie on paper. The fun moments in the movie are little bits of relief for the audience and an excuse to get Chevy Chase to do something silly and get a laugh. But the premise of the movie is not fun, and it's not supposed to be.
I think when you have elements of imagination, this is where critics really don't go far enough. When you say the word imagination, it should automatically translate to fun. It should translate to something that's goofy. And that's not what it is here, because you do have a lot of imagination, and its true intent, you're right, isn't supposed to be fun. But if I were to play devil's advocate, the movie doesn't really, and I think this is where a lot of critics had the problem with it, doesn't really have a moment to show the audience what it wants to be. It shows the imagination. It kind of is linear. It kind of has jokes here and there. It kind of has a little romance and drama, but it just kind of lands in the middle. So I think that is where we get a lot of critics' opinions of what the hell is this movie, but it really doesn't have to be anything. And I think what I'm disappointed with Roger is he should know better when it comes to adding something unique to a movie of imagination, of addressing a lot of these questions. And the automatic arrow that we go to is it has some good jokes here and there. It's kind of has some fun, but it really doesn't have some fun addressing these things. How much fun can you have watching food digest in an invisible man? So that is addressing a question that I think some of us might have if we become invisible. But I think he does have a little bit of mild fun with it that's appropriate. We see him trying to eat with kitchen utensils where he can't use a fork. I think these are fun ideas that it uses that are real. And it doesn't have to go into the comedy element. And I think going back to our original point, that's where I think if you took Chevy Chase out of it and had a more serious actor, Roger would have a different point of view where he's not expecting this to be fun.
No, yeah, I agree with that 100%. And the fun moments that we get from Chevy Chase, when they go to dinner at the restaurant, she's made him up like a dummy and he's got these aviator goggles on and the terrible wig and the dentures, that is making fun of the situation. It's giving us some goofy Chevy Chase. We have to have some goofy Chevy Chase. But then also they do expose the reality to that, where it's like just a simple blot on the lips from a napkin gives the show away. So yeah, there is no going back to normal for this guy. And that's part of the hero's journey we have to take, is that this isn't a blessing. This is a curse. And the only way out of it, apparently, is if he dies or just accepts it and finds someone who will accept it with him. That's a part of the story that we don't get in other Invisible Man movies. And yeah, I think I really like it. And the fact that Roger, like you said, he wants more fantasy and fun. But then again, we've done plenty of interviews or plenty of reviews of these episodes where, oh, it's too much fantasy and it's too much fun. It's an inconsistent expectation.
I don't think they really tried with this picture. In fact, I didn't think there were very many funny moments at all. And another thing is, if he's invisible, why can't you always see his clothing? Sometimes his clothing, I think, is he's totally invisible. They make lots of logical errors on that. They should have figured that out. And I think you're absolutely right. Why not do, I expect, especially if Chevy Chase is going to be in this picture, I figure, all right, he's going to really get into the psychology of what it's like to be invisible and dig deeper into that. Make it more of an internal story.
And that's not what happens.
No!
Okay, so I disagree with both of them. The movie is mostly that. It is him coming to terms with the psychology of being invisible, of learning how to eat, and not paying attention, Gene. His clothes that he wore into that sauna when he was turned invisible, those clothes remain invisible. It's other people's clothes that he puts on that's kind of the sight gags are, where he's running down the beach and he's in his jogging shorts and like a little headband, right? Or when he's fishing. That is the story. It's something he completely missed. He must not have been paying attention to that. And they both weren't paying attention to the fact that a good half of this movie is all about the psychology of him being invisible. I don't know how they missed the boat on that.
Well, not only that, but let's take even within the first 15, 20 minutes of the film, we have a character that is so easily dislikable. You have a lazy worker, a womanizer to a point. And we have the filmmakers, John Carpenter especially, has to convince us to root for this character. It has to convince us to really kind of go along with this journey with the character. And we don't go all in on it, but we are attracted to how he's presenting himself as invisible. We are attracted to how he's identifying the conflict at hand. So he doesn't, it's, again, I use the word linear quite a bit because this movie perfectly balances the character performances of not going all in, but not going below the belt. It really does address more of the imagination piece of it and allowing the special effects affect the performance. So I think when it comes to, if you're going to nitpick clothes that you, again, you're not paying attention to because it's the same damn tuxedo or suit that he's wearing the entire movie. But even more so, look at the pieces where he has to find places to sleep. It's a pool table. It's a street. It's a cabin. These, they could have easily just said, let's have him sneak into a hotel and call it good. Nobody's going to find him there. But they use creative situations to have him identify hardship of this situation. He doesn't have to sleep on a pool table, but this is the cards that he's dealt right now. This is the place that he's at that he has to identify the conflict. So we get prime examples of how Chevy Chase is really identifying this, and yet our critics are still using the term fun. It's not fun to sleep on a pool table. It's not fun to sleep on a street. It's not fun to kind of knock somebody out and pull somebody in a cab just to find a place to go. This isn't fun. So at one point, if the movie gave hints other than Chevy Chase that this was supposed to be something that it wasn't, then I can see the intent of hating this movie, but they are focused, both of them, on this fun element and the special effects that they don't find logical. But let me tell you, they are logical because it's going with the creator's intent of showing a subtle version of hardship and conflict.
The key to humor in a movie like this is to apply absolute rigid logic to an absurd situation. For example, how about the fillings in his teeth? How about his contact lenses? How about if he has dirt underneath his fingernails? What's invisible and what isn't? And you could have a lot of fun by really getting nitpicky about stuff.
Well,
like
even
that.
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids did a better job of following the consequences of its characters in an improbable situation. This film really isn't much of an attempt at all.
Again, I think that they just totally miss the point of what this movie is trying to be. They keep looking for fun where there really isn't supposed to be fun. And Roger keeps looking for logic in a film that there really isn't supposed to be logic, right? If you're dealing with an invisible man, you kind of have to let logic go out the window. They'll science you in the movie. Like, for example, because it is more modern, the henchmen have infrared goggles so they can see him. That's cool. That's something they wouldn't have had in the 1930s version, right? But because this is a modern film, they use technology to find him, which makes the stakes of him being invisible even that much greater because he's not safe. He can't just hide in a corner. They can find him. And since they are using his own psychology against him to find out where he could be, he has several lines to designate that. It means that they did their homework in the writing knowing that he has a psychological profile that Sam Neill's going to use against him. There is so much groundwork in the storytelling of this movie, probably because it came from the novel, but it actually makes its way into the film, and it's great. So that is where I think I do have sympathy for this movie of having, let's say, more flaws than are probably acceptable to most moviegoers and critics. But if you can just forgive those flaws and forgive the behind-the-scenes turmoil of Chevy Chase is an asshole to work with, and so is Daryl Hannah, apparently, and John Carpenter almost quit making movies because of this movie. Some of that might show up on the screen, but at the end of the day, when you think about what this movie is and why it is the way it is such an underrated piece of film from the 90s. It really is.
I'm going to go and say Roger wasn't looking for fun. He was looking for flaws. He went into this. He's contradicting himself because, sure, dirt under the fingernails, a cavity, whatever it may be. What if he didn't shower for a couple days. What if dandruff just appears? What if he gets plaque on his teeth? Does that appear? He wasn't looking for fun. He was looking for an Invisible Man documentary.
So he was looking for loopholes.
Yeah.
He was looking for loopholes so he could pick apart the mechanism of the movie to help build his case against it.
If this movie was fun, he would have sucked all the fun out of it because right. It is hard to balance a lot of the logic that he wants of an Invisible Man that's an imaginary character of fantasy, and he wanted something of logic. Those two, when it comes to logic and fantasy, they don't cross hairs. They are two separate elements. So what he wanted was a funny movie of logic, something that is creative. That would have been everybody wants. That would be the best movie of the year. If you can balance all these elements and make an Invisible Man movie to have drama, comedy, logic. This was Roger wanted this to be the perfect movie for him, but it's impossible. As we spoke to in the beginning, that this has a lot to juggle. And when it comes to balance, yet flawed, it still works at an entertainment level and at a fantasy level and an imaginative level. So this is purely there just to entertain, and critics missed that element. Every critic, I think, went into this wanting something more based on their expectation. This is a movie that was set up for failure with critics.
I'm not sure if it would fare much better in modern times, honestly, but I think that there's some of us that really see the labor of love out of Chevy Chase and this material, and given the opportunity to deliver a role that's a lot more dramatic and serious than the goofy guy who wears a bunch of funny disguises and trips over stuff, right? Like, you almost see him trying to break away from that. And I think that's where audiences rebelled against him. It's like, no, that's not the Chevy Chase that we want or like. So I expel you, essentially, is what they're saying. And then John Carpenter, I really don't know if John Carpenter as a name at this point in time was an audience draw. Because he's a genre filmmaker. Horror people, for sure. Like, sign me up. But then when John Carpenter goes off brand, that might be a little bit more challenging for his crowd. And then if the rest of the movie going public isn't bought into the idea of Chevy Chase in a not so funny role, well, that's a double negative now, you know? So like we said, wrong time, wrong audiences. But like I said, as a cult film, this holds up. It's got a Shout Factory Blu-ray special edition that sold out immediately because people love this movie. They wanted the best version of it because they remembered how good it was, and they probably wish that more people would just watch it and give it a chance.
What I appreciate about watching this movie now, and we don't get enough of it, is just the nostalgic feel of a noir film that we don't get enough of in current times. And those watching it now, this is going to be probably the closest you're going to get to a movie from the 90s to 2000s that's really going to have that real feel to it. And I think if we go back to, say, the late 80s to early 90s, I mean, Chevy Chase had an expectation. If we remember that Michael Keaton, people revolted against him being Batman. People,
yeah, they were pissed.
Cherished their comedians at this point in time. And again, Chevy Chase, we said it, it's the wrong time. This one, I think, would have been, again, like I said, more successful a little bit later down the road, kind of getting Chevy Chase's feet wet and a lot more dramatic stuff to prepare audiences. Batman worked well for Michael Keaton because it was a superhero. This one is kind of below that and wants to be a superhero, but it's just not big budget enough, and it doesn't have a character people are familiar with.
So when it comes to the critique of these guys, well, I mean, I was just so disappointed in both of them because they totally missed the boat, which at this time meant that a lot of America missed the boat as well because they were taking cues from these critics, watching their show every week. So I can see how this had a $40 million budget and it made $14 million. It was a bomb. It did not do well. But those of us who know, know. So, you know, since this was Roger mostly driving the conversation and Gene essentially echoing what Roger was saying with a little bit more Gene spice to it, the fact that he missed the boat, again, we're not paid podcasters. We do this on our own. But we pay so much attention to the films that we critique as to not come off ignorant to the fact that there's story cues that we missed, or maybe some kind of plot twist that we didn't see coming. I get it. They watch a lot of movies, but Gene was not paying attention, and his major complaints about this movie, those are in the movie. He just wasn't paying attention, didn't see them. To me, that is shoddy journalism, so I give him a D on this critique.
And I can't go anything past that, because Roger, again, is the driver of this, and every other sentence was fun. This wasn't fun. It wasn't fun enough. That's
why isn't it fun?
And then going into logic, it was a very contradicting review of what he wanted from this movie. It wasn't clear what he wanted, and it didn't really piece together what went wrong or why people shouldn't go see this, other than it's not fun. But guess what? People watch it now, and it's a lot of fun. It has great pacing. It has familiar tones that a vast audience is going to enjoy. So to me, this one was a very disappointing Ebert review. I'm giving him 1 star.
Yeah, and rightfully so. So yeah, so when it comes down to it, we both agree. You should revisit Memoirs of an Invisible Man. Just do what we suggest and not what these guys did, and go in there with an open mind and expect a noir film, a detective film, but with some fun elements to it. Do not go in this movie looking for a fun movie with some noir elements or detective elements or monster elements, because that's not what this is. It's the opposite. And I think you'll have a much better time watching the movie with that state of mind than these guys going in expecting a slapstick Chevy Chase comedy and getting a semi-serious John Carpenter experience instead. So that's where I land on Memoirs of an Invisible Man. Okay, so next week we are doing a listener request. Our friend Mikey, who is in a Discord and also makes comments on our YouTube channel quite a bit, suggested Good Morning Vietnam from 1987. I think that's a great choice because we just did some Vietnam films. We just had conversations about Robin Williams and movies over the last season. So now we get to do the quintessential Robin Williams movie of the 80s, in my opinion. It's the one that I think he got the most recognition for, and the fact that it is a Vietnam film in this 3-4 year period of so many Vietnam films, I think Good Morning Vietnam was a great choice for this show.
Fantastic choice. And this one is my origin movies of my love for film. So this one I'm excited to talk about. It's a fantastic pick. Can't wait to talk about this one.
100%. And we've got a couple more listener requests coming up after that, too. So keep sending them in. They're finally flowing in, and we're working them into our routine. And then it's funny because one of our listeners made a comment about the film Baby's Day Out today. And I mentioned to them, like, oh, yeah, well, I totally talked about that movie in my Cop and a Half episode, which hasn't come out yet. So it's in the zeitgeist that Baby's Day Out just might have to land on the show this year.
It is a great review from Siskel and Ebert. It's almost role reversal between Home Alone 3 and Roger and Gene between these two. So that one is going to be an interesting conversation, and just shows, again, a lot of contradiction from our critics.
Exactly, just like this one. So that'll be on the list as well. All right, everyone. So thank you for watching, listening. Please like, review, rate 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And if you're watching us on YouTube, leave us a review, subscribe, share the link for your friends. If you have a Siskel and Ebert episode in mind of a film they talked about, send it to us. We'll put it into the listener request list and get it on the show. In the meantime, you can visit me, Antonio, over at the Cultworthy Cinema Podcast at thecultworthy.com. You can find my friend Justin Henson over at
themoviewire.com.
And we'll see you next week.
See you next week.